Hello, I'm Yogi Akal. This is number 0480, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0480. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, thriller writer Peter James talks about his new novel, Absolute Proof, which answers the question of what would you do if you received a phone call from a stranger claiming to have absolute proof of the existence of God.
I got a phone call out of the blue. It's an elderly sounding guy, and he said, "Is that Peter James, the author?" And I go, "Yes." And he said, "Thank God I found you. It's taken me 2 weeks. So I phoned every Peter James in the phone book in the South, in England." He said, "I'm not a lunatic, Mr. James. My name is Harry Nixon. I was a bomber pilot in the Second World War. I'm a retired university academic. I have been given absolute proof of God's existence, and I've been told you're the man to help me get taken seriously."
Clinical forensic psychologist Dr. John Huber is back on, this time to talk about Facebook and depression. Can depression really be assessed based on your Facebook posts?
Properly trained people or an appropriate algorithm can do that. In fact, there's been talk for probably the last 7 or 8 years that Facebook has actually got some algorithms out there that can pretty well identify things like suicide, and there's some concerns that maybe they don't go far enough to identify the suicidal patient. The problem is, you start doing that, now all of a sudden you have done an assessment, a mental health assessment, which violates HIPAA laws in the United States, without consent of the person you did the assessment on.
And there's lots and lots and lots of Stuff File news, and of course, an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0480 was Yogi Akal, who is a speaker, activist, teacher, counselor, healer, and numerologist. Back on the old radio show I did, he was our numerologist, and we used to refer to him as Agia Akal Singh Khalsa, numerologist to the stars. You can, by the way, check out his website, which is Yogi Akal, and you'll find the link to that website on our website at thestufffile.com by just simply going to the show listed under this number, which he just mentioned, number 0480. See how it all goes around full circle? Yeah, the circle of life. Thank you, Yogi Akal, or as we like to call him, just between him and me, Gus. Thank you very much for being the person to do the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? You have to be careful who you have a three-way with. When you're naked with two other people, you are very vulnerable, and you never know if one of those people is going to be jealous, vindictive, irresponsible, obsessive, or maybe a psychotic meth head with a taste for human flesh. For instance, I'm guessing this poor guy in South Carolina who was viciously attacked in the middle of a three-way wishes he had been a little more discriminating about who he invited into his bedroom. Plus, his penis would probably still be intact. A man called police for help, saying a woman tried to bite off his penis during sex with him and another man. Police in South Carolina say a naked woman tried to bite off a man's genitals and then rushed on all fours at responding officers who shocked her with a stun gun. Hananan Police Chief Dennis Turner says officers shocked the bloody woman with a stun gun, then used an overdose fighting drug to revive her. Officers were told she was high on heroin and methamphetamine. Said Turner, "Honestly, it's one of the most disturbing body cam videos I have seen in my career. It honestly reminded me of something you would see in a horror movie." The woman was hospitalized. Charges are pending. Okay, I'm no prude, but I do have to say that I'm just not three-way material. I've mentioned this before and it bears repeating. I'll share an analogy as to why I'm not interested. Have you ever driven your car in the flow of traffic and the car in front of you decides that he wants to clean his windshield, so he hits the button on his windshield washer fluid and starts the wipers, and some of that fluid comes over the top of his car and hits your windshield? I mean, his fluid on your car! Think about that analogy. Now apply it to a three-way. That's why I'm out. Yeah. Okay. A North Alabama burglary suspect was taken into custody after bathing, washing clothes, clipping his toenails, and cooking in a stranger's house. Limestone County investigators say Tyler Keith Love made himself at home in a woman's house. The woman wasn't home at the time, but returned to find Love in her house, according to sheriff spokesperson Stephen Young. "What are you doing in my home?" the woman shouted at Love. Love replied, "Washing clothes, Grandmama." Police went to the home after the woman called for help. They found evidence that Love had spent a good deal of time inside the victim's home. Evidence showed that Love had washed his clothes, taken a bath, clipped his toenails, and searched through the woman's cabinets, drawers, and jewelry boxes. Love had also cooked a sandwich with a fresh onion, eggs, ham, butter, mayonnaise, and cheese that he found in the victim's house. But he didn't get a chance to eat it before he was arrested. Deputies believe Love was under the influence of narcotics. Ya figure? Usually when you burgle someone's home, the idea is to get in and out with relative speed. If you feel that you have enough time to cook a meal, you're overconfident. If you feel you have enough time to clip your toenails, then you must be high. What I want to know is who gets to eat the sandwich he made. I mean, I hate to see good food go to waste. Yeah. 75-year-old Helen Washington of Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, faces charges of second-degree assault with a dangerous weapon after she ran out of patience on October 12th with her grandson, who continued to put his teacup on her furniture even though she repeatedly asked him not to. After dumping out his tea, Washington left the room, apparently to get a gun. Meanwhile, the grandson had made a new cup of tea and put it on the furniture as he did with the first one. The argument resumed, and Washington pulled out the .38 special, shooting her grandson in the leg. She told officers at the scene she didn't think she should go to jail. A judge ordered her to have an evaluation to see if she's competent to stand trial. Seriously, if I had disrespected my grandmother and her furniture that way, she wouldn't have to use a gun. I would have just simply disappeared without a trace, and the only faded memory of me would be a portrait photo sitting on the piano. There's a lesson to be learned here. Respect your elders. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, an ethics panel has found probable cause against a Florida mayor accused of soliciting sex from a resident in exchange for installing speed bumps in her neighborhood. In a statement, the Florida Commission on Ethics said it found probable cause that Lantana Mayor David Stewart misused his position to attempt to obtain a sexual benefit for himself. Stewart may settle the case on request of a hearing before an administrative law judge. He has denied the allegations. He told the Dayton Beach News Journal that it was inappropriate to comment at this time. Oh, now things are inappropriate. Okay. In her January complaint to the commission, Catherine Padilla said Stewart promised the speed bumps she wanted as a safety measure would be approved if she had sex with him. The town approved the speed bumps, by the way, in 2015. Speed bump sounds more like speed bump and grind. I think the mayor is the one who really needs to slow down a bit here, don't you? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? One of my favorite novelists is Peter James. He's the best-selling author behind the Detective Superintendent Roy Gray series of books, which are absolutely marvelous, by the way. But Peter now has a new novel out that is not part of the Roy Gray series. It's a thriller called Absolute Proof, and it delves into a very simple question. What would you do if you received a phone call from a stranger claiming to have absolute proof of the existence of God. Peter joins us on the line right now via Skype from his home across the pond in England. Hi, Peter.
Hey, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. Now, I understand that the genesis, pardon the pun, or idea for this book came from a real-life phone call that you received nearly 30 years ago?
Yeah, it was one afternoon back in 1989, and it was before I was ex-directory. Luckily, as it happened, and I got a phone call out of the blue. There's an elderly-sounding guy, and he said, "Is that Peter James, the author?" And I go, "Yes." And he said, "Thank God I found you. It's taken me 2 weeks. So I phoned every Peter James in the phone book in England." I said, "Okay." He said, "I'm not a lunatic, Mr. James. My name is Harry Nixon. I was a bomber pilot in the Second World War. I'm a retired university academic. I have been given absolute proof of God's existence. And I've been told you're the man to help me get taken seriously."
Wow.
I said, "Do you want to tell me a little bit more?" He said, "Yes." He said, "I need to come and see you, Mr. James. I'm going to need 4 days of your time." I said, "Mr. Nixon, I'm a pretty busy guy. You know, 4 days is quite a big ask. And would you like to tell me a little bit more first?" He said, "Yes." He said, "My wife recently died of cancer. And before she died, we made an agreement I'd go to a medium and try and communicate with her. And I did this a few months after she'd passed away. And instead of my wife coming through, a male came through who said he was a representative of God, that God was extremely concerned about the state of the world and felt that if mankind could have faith in him reaffirmed, it would get us back on an even keel. And as proof of his bona fides, he gave me 3 pieces of information that nobody on earth knows. And he said, the author, Peter James, is the man to help you get taken seriously."
Wow.
Quite a few people would probably have hung up at that point, but I think probably like you, Peter, and from my past talks with you, I know what an inquisitive mind you have. And I'm a person who believes that everybody you ever meet in life has a story. Sometimes it might be a pretty boring one, but people are worth talking to, worth listening to. And something about this guy intrigued me, and I said, "Look, Mr. Nixon, I'll give you half an hour. If we need more time than that, we'll take it from there." So he arranged to come down the following Tuesday. I thought 4 o'clock in the afternoon would be safe because my wife would have been home at 5:30, and if he had been a stranglehold, she could have bashed him over the head. And he rocked up. He came down from Stoke-on-Trent up in the Midlands on the nanosecond of 4 o'clock, and he looked like a nice-looking man. He looked like in his 70s. He looked like a retired bank manager, you know, neatly dressed. Shook my hand, looked to me in the eye, and said, "Mr. James, you and I have to save the world." I said, "Well, you know, big ask, but I'll do my best." Anyway, I sit him down, and very long story short, I said, "So what are these 3 pieces of information that you have?" He said, "Well, I have been given the location of the Holy Grail, sorry, the location of the tomb of Akhenaten, who was Tutankhamun's uncle, the first monotheist pharaoh, the location of the Holy Grail, and the location of the Ark of the Covenant." And I said, "Have you tried looking for these?" He said, "Yes." He said, I'm a navigator, and I was a pilot in the war. And the compass coordinates for the Holy Grail are at a place called Chalice Well in Glastonbury in Somerset. Now, I'd never heard of Chalice Well at this point. And I then discovered that Chalice Well is a holy site on the edge of Glastonbury where Joseph of Arimathea was rumored to have brought the Holy Grail, the chalice containing Christ's blood from the crucifixion, and concealed it. And he said, "It's run by a group of trustees." He said, "I've been there, and I've been dowsing and metal detecting exactly the spot the coordinates show, and there's something underground. Hmm. I've asked the trustees for permission to do an archaeological dig. They won't take me seriously, but I think they would take you seriously, Mr. James." Anyhow, cut a long story short, the next day, by sheer chance, I had to go to Bristol to do a BBC radio interview. Finish the interview, and I'm just chatting with the presenter. Out of the blue, she mentions Chalice Well. And I think, this is really weird. I've never heard of the place. Now it's twice in 2 days. You know, I said, "What do you know about Chalice Well?" She said, "Oh, my uncle's a trustee." So now I'm thinking, I definitely am the chosen one here. And I was quite freaked by it. And I left, and I rang a friend of mine, who at the time was Bishop of Reading, a guy called Dominic Walker, very modern-thinking clergyman, not, you know, he had a double first in psychology. And I went to go see him a couple of days later, and I told him the story, and I said, what do you think, Dominic? And he said, well, firstly, proof is the enemy of faith. Secondly, I'd want more than three sets of compass coordinates. I would want something that defies the laws of physics of the universe, you know, a pretty big miracle to be convinced of God's existence. And I said, if somebody could deliver that, what then? He looked at me and he said, you know what I really think? That person would be murdered, because whose God would it be? You'd have every different faction of the Anglican, Catholic, Judaic, Islamic, Sikh churches after you. And you'd have communist countries like China not wanting a higher power usurping their authority. And I thought, yes, I have got the makings of a great thriller here.
Okay, so a great, as you say, the makings of a great thriller. But this was an experience you had nearly 30 years ago. So why did you wait so long to write this book, Absolute Proof?
Two reasons. One was I had constant writing contracts for earlier thrillers and for the Roy Gray series, which I had to deliver one a year of. But secondly, I wanted to understand. It was a massive task. I felt in order to write this book, I firstly needed to understand all the world's religions and to understand from the perspective of all senior leaders in every faith group what they would. I talked to everybody I could find, theologians, priests, atheists, scientists who had faith and who didn't, and I'd ask them the two questions. I'd say, what would it take to convince you that God existed, and what do you think the consequences would be? And I realized that for the book to work, I had to deliver an ending that would be a real wow, an ending that even a hardcore atheist would have a problem dismissing, something, you know, as big as the sun rising from the wrong side one day. And that was what took so much time, was doing the research and just learning about that whole vast world of religion, and also at the same time not wanting to offend any religion when I wrote it. And the Da Vinci Code was a great inspiration, because when that book came out, I realized that actually you could write a controversial book about religion without getting murdered. And you know, that Absolute Proof it's in that kind of vein. Yeah, it's a big international thriller. It takes place across England, Egypt, Greece, and America. And I spent 5 days in a very Spartan Greek monastery as part of my research, trying to understand what it took to be a monk and the nature of what faith really was.
Because you've written this book and you've done all of this research to write this book, did it have an effect or change your feelings about religion or spirituality in any way, shape, or form?
Yes, Peter, it's had actually a very profound effect on me. I went to an Anglican school in which I had religion rammed down my throat. And you had to go to chapel every day and 2 hours on Sunday. And I left feeling kind of very much agnostic, veering towards atheist. And I, during the course of this book, my views have sort of changed to the point of, I won't say I'm convinced that there is a God sitting up in the clouds and that we're going to go to some nice, cozy place when we die, but I am absolutely convinced, if you like, at first base, that there is an intelligence behind the cosmos. And what I've noticed is that there are more and more scientists that are also coming to that same conclusion. I think that very recently the head of NASA's 9 billion telescope project said that she was coming to the conclusion that there was an intelligence behind the cosmos. And I think that's a growing view.
We're talking with best-selling thriller author Peter James. His new book, just out, is called Absolute Proof. And we'll continue talking with Peter. We'll take a quick break and talk more with Peter in just a moment.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. This broadcast is coming to you from upstairs. Get out of the house.
And still to come on the program, we'll continue our conversation with Peter James. His new book is called Absolute Proof. Also, Dr. John Huber is back on the show to talk about Facebook and depression. We do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on, and more Stuff File news a little later on as well on this program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Play and iTunes. Just click the Google Play or iTunes button located on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Okay, let's get back to our conversation with Peter James. We're talking with writer Peter James, author of Absolute Proof, a thriller that delves into the existence of God. Peter, the takeaway I get from hearing your story about meeting with Harry Nixon, who contacted you 30 years ago, was that he got a sign that you were one of the people who could help him. You are, in a strange way, the chosen one. That must be pretty heady from your perspective to deal with that.
It has been very strange. And what's been even more strange has been the whole journey of the book has been beset by a series of kind of interesting and nice coincidences all the way down the line. The most recent significant one was that I fictionalized that Harry Nixon, I made his name Harry Cook in the book. And after I finished the book, we thought it'd be interesting to see if he was still alive, because I'd met him in 1989 and he was knocking on in years then. And my wonderful PA Linda managed to find out that he died about 5 years ago, but found the estate agents that had sold his house, and they left my phone number with them, said, look, if any of the family would like to speak to Peter. And I got a phone call 2 days later from a doctor in Cambridge who said, I'm Harry's grandson, and he would be over the moon to know that you've written this book. And anyway, he and his brother and sister came and had tea with my wife, Laura, and I just after Christmas this last year. And I wanted to know, I said, what was your grandfather like? You know, was he sane? Was he nuts? They said he was incredibly sane. We spoke to some of his crew who crewed with him in the Air Force in the war, and they said he was a guy you'd want in a plane in a crisis. And they said he also wasn't religious, but he just believed he had been given this mission to show the world that God really did exist. And we were talking, and the chap said, you know, what name have you given him in the book? And I said, I've called him Harry Cook. And both brothers and sister went sheet white, and they said that was the name of the medium that he went to try and contact our grandmother.
Wow.
And there's been sort of one coincidence after another that kind of, it's almost like, I'm not saying that there's something out there that's been driving the book all along, but there's been enough little things to sort of make me think, like the BBC radio interview and her uncle being a trustee at Chalice Well. And the book ended up writing itself almost. It was quite strange. And I planned it, I guess, for a long time. But another kind of coincidence was that I tore my ankle running back in the beginning of 2016, and it wasn't getting any better, and I went to various specialists, had all the MRI scans, and the specialist said, you need an operation on your ankle and heel, and it's going to hobble you, and you're not going to be able to walk for 2 to 3 months. So I booked the operation in for mid-October 2016, and I just cleaned my diary. No appointments. I had 3 months completely clear water. And 4 days before the operation, a friend of mine who's a podiatrist, big surgeon himself, said, I want you to have a second opinion. And I went to a second opinion, and the guy said, I don't think you should have the operation. You should try wearing that foot brace that Andy Murray wears, and I think you'd be able to actually get back to running and sport without the operation. And he said, you can always have it in 6 months' time. So suddenly, I had 3 months of a completely clear diary. And I just sat down and I wrote the book in 8 weeks. It's the longest book I've ever written, and it normally takes me 7 months to write a Roy Grace novel, and I wrote this in just on 2 months. You can almost sort of say, did the ankle injury and all that happen again to give me the time to write it? It's very strange. And I'm not a woo-woo person at all, but so much of the book fell into place. And I love it. It's, I've written it from the sort of perspective of a number of different characters. The central character is a Sunday Times Insight newspaper reporter who gets the phone call that I got. And then one of the main characters is one of these phony billionaire television evangelists who's got churches all over UK and America and his own private 777 jet. And he's terrified that if God was proven, he'd be shown up to be a fraud. And another central character is the boss of one of the world's largest pharmaceutical giants who would love to get his hands on Jesus Christ's DNA because that would add massive value to all his kind of pharmaceuticals. And a kind of third perspective is the Catholic Church who would dearly love to get their hands on it for reasons I'm sure we can understand.
Now, I know with your Detective Gray series, you do a lot of work with police and other people. I've talked about this with you before in doing the research to write those books. I would assume you have just done as much research to write this book. Was it a different prospect when you were dealing with religious types, religious figures, to do research for this particular book than previous works that you had done?
I tend to follow the same kind of patterns when I'm researching, and that if I'm whatever aspect of the police I'm with for one of my Roy Grace books, I will always tell them what I'm doing, and I will always send them the pages or the chapters or even the finished book for them to look at and for them to correct. And I had tremendous help across all the religions in this, and including from the UK the chief multi-faith advisor. I wanted to get everything on the religious side of it right, and B, I didn't want to upset any religion. So I had huge help from the Church of England, from a number of bishops who read the book, from the Catholic Church in the UK, from Judaic, and from the Islamic Church, and from a senior Sikh. And it was quite funny, actually. I had the Archbishop of Canterbury heard about the book, and he invited my wife, Laura, and I to tea last summer at Lambeth Palace, to drinks, rather, at Lambeth Palace. And he said, tell me about the book. So I told him the background, and I said to him, what do you think would happen if somebody could prove conclusively that God existed? And he looked at me, and he smiled, and he said, I'd be out of a job.
With the success you've had in all your writing, and now this book, Absolute Proof, coming out, and the idea, the history of, or the story, rather, of how this book came to be. Now, I hope you're writing for a long, long time. I want more Roy Gray stories for years to come. But at some point, you're going to go to the great beyond. Do you think this book has given you carte blanche past the velvet ropes at the pearly gates?
I think I'd be very presumptuous to say that, but it would be nice to think so. I'd like to have some credit up there. I haven't led a totally blameless life, so maybe you've got to even out the score a little bit. But I think that if Absolute Proof does anything, I think that everyone who reads, by the fact that they're reading, means they're intelligent. And I think that when we read books, we don't just want a story. We want to learn something about the world in which we live, about the human condition, and something from the wisdom, hopeful wisdom of the author. And if the one thing I hope that anyone, and including the great man upstairs, would take away from this book is making people think.
How often do you think about Harry Nixon now that you've written this book?
I think about him quite a lot, and I kind of wonder where he is right now in terms of, is he kind of sitting up there watching down, and Is he going, well, I didn't quite like the way Mr. James described me. I felt I possibly looked a bit younger than he's made me. But I would love to think that he's seen the book happen perhaps I didn't get the message across in the way that he would have wanted in terms of maybe a non-fiction book about it. But I think that through fiction, you can often reach a much bigger audience and much bigger readership than through non-fiction. And I think that it is a massively important subject. I think, we're living in an increasingly kind of secular world, and yet... And we are dominated to a large extent by the arrogance of science. I mean, one of my favorite parts of the book is I've brought in the monkey and typewriter experiment. Do you know about the monkey and typewriter?
Tell us about
it. The monkey and typewriter is a theory that's been used by hardcore atheists for years, and Dawkins uses it. And the theory is that if you had infinity and a monkey sat at a typewriter and typed away forever, eventually, one of the combinations of keystrokes it typed would be the complete works of Shakespeare. And that's used to explain how you and I are sitting, having this conversation, having come out of the primal swamp, two amoebas through random mutations and evolution have now arrived at where we are. And that's been the platform of the hardcore atheists. And there were four really hardcore ones who were known as the Four Horsemen of the New Apocalypse, which was Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, the American Sam Harris, and Douglas Dennett, Daniel Dennett. And there was one atheist even more hardcore than them called Anthony Flew. And Flew was a Cambridge professor and for 40 years was considered the world's most militant atheist. And in 2004, he changed his mind. And he wrote a book in which was titled There Is No God, with the no crossed out and an A replacing it. And two things primarily changed his mind above all else. The first was the discovery of DNA by Crick and Watson. He has felt that the sheer complexity of it could never, ever have come from random mutations. And the second thing that changed his mind was that an astrophysicist friend of his did the monkey and typewriter experiment. He actually put six monkeys in a cage with a perpetual paper feed and an incentive to hit the keys. They'd get a slice of banana every few keystrokes, and he left them for a month. And when he went back, they typed 40 pages, of which there wasn't a single intelligible word, not even an A with a space either side. And Flew's astrophysicist friend did the math, and he calculated that the universe would run out of resources before a monkey randomly typed one Shakespeare sonnet. And I have a hardcore atheist character in the book doing this same experiment with a slightly different, perhaps more interesting result.
The book is called Absolute Proof. As I said earlier, big fan of your work with Superintendent Roy Grace. People are familiar with your Roy Grace books. This is not your first standalone book, but I'm just wondering, for those who may have only read your Roy Grace books, would they recognize your writing style? Roy Grace books are thrillers. They're very fast-paced. Would the same be said of Absolute Proof?
Yeah, Absolute Proof is a fast-paced, twisty thriller. My usual style of kind of short chapters and cliffhangers. And the central character, although for a change he's a newspaper reporter, I realize that there's, and I shadowed one for some time, there's a great similarity between a detective and a newspaper reporter, in that kind of what they do is they both dig deep beneath the surface. They both have a magic card. The police officer has the warrant card, the reporter has the press card that enables them to go behind the scenes of life. And so I think anyone who likes my Roy Grace novels, I think, would like Absolute Proof equally.
That's all the Absolute Proof I need. The book is called Absolute Proof, written by Peter James. Peter, thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Peter, thank you so much. It was great to talk to you.
author Peter James. His new book is Absolute Proof. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0480, and you'll find links to Peter's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Every year, we hold the Wacky Warning Label Contest, and the person who finds the funniest common sense warning label in America wins a prize of $1,000. Over the years, we've seen some pretty hilarious labels, like the one on a motorized go-kart that warned, "This product moves when used," and a fishing lure with huge hooks that warned, "Harmful if swallowed." But did you know that the first wacky label we ever saw came from a Halloween costume? That's right, it was found on a Batman cape. It warned, "Cape does not enable user to fly." Let's be fair, we've had a lot of fun with that one, and when my own boys were young, they appeared on TV shows in France and Japan wearing that cape. The show's hosts asked why there are so many warnings about common sense things in America. The answer is that with all the frivolous lawsuits the product makers have to defend themselves against in the United States, the courts here can sometimes be even scarier than those Halloween costumes. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
You're experiencing the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Sit back, relax, let it rattle around between your ears, tickling your cerebellum, and enjoy.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Dr. John Huber about Facebook and depression. We do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. And much more Stuff File news here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, 42-year-old Atif Masood, an employee at a Tesco supermarket in Thornton Heath in South London, is suing the store over the harassment and racial discrimination he says he suffered when a fellow employee broke wind in his face. The Sun reported Masood claims he was targeted because he is a Muslim, saying the unwanted conduct had the purpose or effect of violating his dignity. Tesco dismissed Masood's complaints in February, saying it found no evidence of racial discrimination. Masood's hearing will take place in 2019. Well, you know, they do eat a lot of cabbage in the UK. Perhaps this is just a dietary and proximity issue. And while we're on the topic of backside trumpeting, a man whose excessive flatulence forced a police detective to cut short an interrogation has pleaded guilty to federal gun and drug charges. 25-year-old Sean Sykes Jr. entered the plea. The charges stem from a police traffic stop in September in Kansas City, Missouri, in which officers found a backpack with drugs and guns. Sykes was a passenger in the vehicle. A detective reported that when asked for his address, Sykes leaned to one side of his chair and released a loud sphincter whistle before answering the question. Court documents say Sykes continued to be flatulent, and the detective was forced to quickly end the interview. Sykes, dubbed the farting felon by the Kansas City Star, will be sentenced at a later date after a pre-sentence report is completed. It's unfortunate when the interrogation room turns into a gas chamber, but I'm guessing Sean will have his diet corrected in prison. And continuing on a theme, 68-year-old William Friedman of Franklin Township, New Jersey, told police officers when he was apprehended that his weird practice of dumping his grandson's used diapers around town was almost a game for him. Friedman had been disposing of soiled nappies along several roadways over the past year until an officer spotted him at 3:15 a.m. on October 21st making another deposit. Not only is the littering disgusting, but officials told the Associated Press that a motorcyclist crashed in June after running over a diaper Friedman had allegedly thrown out. He was charged with interference with transportation and faces up to $1,000 in fines. You know, I'm reminded of my youth when I used to work at a drive-in theater. It was a great job, and there was one aspect of this job, though, that was truly disgusting. And by the way, it was a big drive-in, a really big drive-in. two screens with room for 1,900 cars. Anyway, the first job we had to do in the day to prepare the drive-in for another night of customers was drive around the lot with a front-end loader picking up the litter that was left behind by people who, the night before, had just opened their car windows and chucked the stuff out. This included food they didn't eat, drink cups, popcorn containers, and yes, dirty diapers. We would be battling with pigeons and seagulls as we tried to clean up the mess. And imagine what it was like if overnight or while we were cleaning up, it rained. Oh, it was ripe. Really, really ripe. Yeah. Anyway, we have time for one more story before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. In an apparent attempt to destroy what little brain power he had left, 26-year-old Brandon McVeigh of Council Bluffs, Iowa, ate a Tide Pod, prompting a trip to the hospital. But while he was being treated in the critical care unit, McVeigh went on a rampage early on October 4th, causing thousands of dollars of damage to medical equipment. A nurse told the responding police officer that McVeigh was yelling loudly as he broke objects in his room before proceeding to the hallway. Keyboards, computer monitors, and glass, valued at more than $7,500, were found littering the hallway where McVeigh was subdued by security guards before police arrived. McVeigh was arrested and held at the hospital on charges of second-degree criminal mischief and disorderly conduct in a place of business. You see, boys and girls, this is why you shouldn't drive or use heavy equipment or try to type when you're under the influence of a Tide Pod. Remember, let your laundry take a beating, not your internal organs. Okay? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? According to a study, Facebook posts might be able to predict whether users are suffering from depression. Researchers found the words people use in their posts indicate whether they are in need of mental health support for possible depression. Joining us to talk about this is clinical forensic psychologist Dr. John Huber. He's the chairman for Mainstream Mental Health, which is a nonprofit organization. John joins us on the line right now from Texas. Hi, John.
Hello, Peter. Thank you for having me on today.
Nice to have you back on the program with us once again. So do you put any credence into this idea that Facebook posts might reveal your depression?
Well, I think they do. But the problem is the data they're looking at, if you think about psychology, we have objective measures and subjective measures. And so when somebody comes in and get an IQ test, I can give them a series of activities that have been set up and actuarially based answers, and we can sit down and say, okay, this makes an IQ of 100. With mental health issues like depression, which is what they're targeting, a lot of the words and the terminology and phrasing that they're using is subjective. For example, Instagram believes that they can tell if you're depressed if you post more black and white pictures than you do color pictures. And that goes back to black and white, oftentimes in some people's eyes, seems more gloomy and depressing. However, I've gone through and looked at Instagram pages of photographers who only do black and white, and they have some amazing pictures that are not even close to being depressed. So I think using that subjective tool leaves doubt. And what I mean by that is the Rorschach ink blot test is subjective. It's based on the clinician's experience and training. And it's very difficult to present that data in a courtroom setting because it's not actuarially based. So what that means is that there's a lot of room for improvement in your diagnostic criteria and things like that. So they're using keywords to identify, for example, if you use the word miss a lot, like I miss my friends, I miss my father, I miss, well, they're saying that means that you must be depressed. Well, until you start talking about some of the athletes out there talking about missing a catch or missing a pass. And so that skews the whole data. It is very subjective. I think properly trained people or an appropriate algorithm
can do that. In fact, there's been talk for probably the last 7 or 8 years that Facebook has actually got some algorithms out there that can pretty well identify things like suicide, and there's some concerns that maybe they don't go far enough to identify the suicidal patient. The problem is, you start doing that, now all of a sudden you have done an assessment, a mental health assessment, which violates HIPAA laws in the United States, without consent of the person you did the assessment on. And now disclosing that information and making it available violated HIPAA laws again. So it becomes a big legal mess. So I don't think we're ever going to get to the point where it's going to be, hey, we can just go through here and weed out everybody who has depression and call them up and say, hey, go see your doctor or get on antidepressants. I don't think we're ever going to get to that point because there's too many legal loopholes in there and too much confidentiality and medical record data that's going to get released if they do this the wrong way. I think there is some validity to it. I think you can go through and look at those, but I think you need to be appropriately trained and licensed in order to do that.
Well, 2 points, and also a point on what you just said about being licensed and a professional at this. 2 points. One, I was a photography student back in school, and I love black and white pictures, and I don't think I'm in any way, shape, or form depressed. So, and I post a lot of black and white pictures. Two, just because of the nature of the business I'm in, and I've been on Facebook since the beginning, basically, I'm near the maximum of the amount of quote unquote friends I'm allowed to have, which is 5,000. So in my feed, there's a lot going on in my news feed. And I have noticed over the years that posts in general, and not just posts, but comments to otherwise non-depressing posts have become somewhat depressing, for lack of a better term, what I call the Debbie Downers out there. You'd be writing a post about something, and it's all light and breezy, and someone will come in with a comment, and it's like, really, where did that come from? You know, so I'm
I know what you're talking about. Yes, sir.
So I'm just wondering, based on what you said at the end of your answer, being a professional that you are, when you are on Facebook, do you see things that send, as a professional, red flags up for you?
Yes. And the individuals, you're not a real friend with all 5,000 people on your page there.
And I wish, by the way,
the ones that you are.
I wish, by the way, that the people on Facebook would be aware of that. Because there are some people who take the idea of friend, which is why I said in quotes, they take friend too seriously on Facebook.
Yes.
They're not.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
But if it was an IRL, in real life friend, and you saw something like that, you know, we're the kind of people we step up to the plate, pick up the phone, call them, say, hey, what's going on? Do we need to get you some help? What's the matter? And I do that. In fact, my kid, 13 and 16, over the years have brought me their classmates that are having issues like that. And every one of them, we ended up getting in with their parents and getting them mental health support because there were issues that were valid. In fact, even a couple of suicidal issues that were, you know, on the verge of, they were ready to go find a bridge to jump off of.
How do you define between someone who is suffering with mental illness in one way, shape, or form, from someone who has, say, like myself, a dark sense of humor? there are some posts I have on Facebook that I know that people question my sanity from time to time, and some people who just don't find them politically correct, which is another problem.
That's a whole other issue.
That's a whole other issue.
Discussion.
Yeah.
The fine line is a lot involved with the person's character. You know, if everything is doom and gloom and they throw out something like that, that's a red flag versus you're not all doom and gloom. You're talking about all aspects of life and you throw that out there. And of course I'm sitting there going, oh, I wish I'd have found that and sent it out first. But,
But you know, I think there is that balance that's out there, and a lot of times it takes someone who either has, you know, you are a pretty good judge of character because you have that sense of humor, and you see somebody responding the way they do, you go, wait a minute, that's not a normal response. Something is wrong with this person. And that's kind of the benchmark that lay people can say is like, wait a minute, that's just off. And if all of a sudden you're a lay person and you're not trained, and all of a sudden you're like, oh my God, that's obsessive compulsive disorder, now you've got a problem, because there's some need you have to label people, and you should probably go talk to your therapist at that point. But if you're just going, wait, that doesn't feel right, it doesn't sound right, that's not in character with this person or with the chain of responses of the post. And those are oftentimes the biggest red flag. And that's what brought my kids, you know, my kids to say, something's not right here. I know what dad does. And they go and get dad. And dad, look at this. This isn't right. Something's not right here. And that's when you need to go and pick up the phone and call somebody and get things happening. In fact, one of the kiddos had moved, and the parents had actually changed their numbers. We tried to call the parents. And we didn't know how to get a hold of this individual, and literally was actively suicidal in their post. And actually, we called and sent a message. Actually, we didn't call them. We sent a message to the administration on Snapchat, and they contacted us within a half an hour, and they already got the hold of the family for us.
Wow. Now, this study, by the way, is not done by Facebook. It's done by the National Academy of Sciences, yep. Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. But having said that, you know all the trouble that Facebook has been in over the last little while, and now there's a study like this. Do you think this is something that Facebook should be concerned with themselves? They should police it? Or is it not something that is within their purview to literally be, for lack of a better term, nanny state to all of us?
Well, going back to how I kind of ended that first question, we started talking about it, these HIPAA things. Unless they're going to hire a bevy of therapists and psychologists and psychiatrists to sit there and go through and monitor and make clinical decisions on these, and even if they did, they would have to start changing their EULA agreement so that you're agreeing to that, allow them to do psychological testing on your responses and posts, and that's just going to go too far. I don't really believe it is their responsibility. I think parents should be monitoring kids, and as you become eligible adults, I mean, we allow people to go smoke and drink and do all these things that will eventually kill us, so why would we get in the way of them making posts on social media?
And on that note, I'll just continue to be on Facebook and be happy. John,
exactly.
John, I thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. You have such an amazing show.
Dr. John Huber, Chairman for Mainstream Mental Health. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0480, and you'll find links to John's site. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. I've got another Stuff File news story I want to get to before we get to the idiot of the day to end the program with, and here is that story. 68-year-old Edwin Smith of Shelby, North Carolina, popped out his back door to feed the squirrels, forgetting that he had set up a shotgun as a booby trap in case anyone ignored his sign warning crackheads, drug dealers, and illegal aliens to stay off his property. "I blew my arm off," Smith calmly told a sheriff's dispatcher when he called 911. "I'm going to die. I'm in the driveway. I'm going to die." He didn't die, thanks to a sheriff's deputy staunching Smith's severe bleeding with a tourniquet before medics arrived. So, I'm guessing Smith will have to change his sign because clearly he isn't a crackhead or a drug dealer or an illegal alien. He'll have to add forgetful moron to his list. Yeah. And speaking of morons, boys and girls, it's the moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Crime doesn't pay, especially when you're supposed to be working for the other side. Authorities say a police officer who worked for the Bonifay Police Department, located in the Florida Panhandle, was arrested for allegedly selling opioids out of his marked squad car while in uniform. Officer Dwayne White was arrested while at the Bonifay Police Department by agents from the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. The FDLE began its investigation of White last month after the Holmes County Sheriff's Office referred their suspicions to them. Undercover agents made a controlled purchase of opioid tablets from White while he was in uniform in his marked squad car. White also allegedly used his personal cell phone for sales. The officer was charged with selling a controlled substance and unlawful use of a two-way communications device. Now, why, oh why, would you be brazen enough to try to sell drugs from your police car while in uniform and using your own phone to make the deals? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0480. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links to all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0480. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. While it may be an enjoyable, pleasant experience, some side effects may occur. Listening to Peter may cause bloating, drowsiness, Tourette's, web feet, or an oily discharge.